see in childhood, and I find this stuff personally kind of fascinating, because this is the root of all of us, kind of how we came to be who we are, and what created that. Whether it's our parents, whether it's our biology, how that works, how we end up to be the way we are. That's what we're going to be looking at, not only in this chapter, but in the next chapter. We'll start off with infancy and childhood, looking at the early years, and then we're going to look at adolescence, which is all the way kind of in between childhood, all the way up to quote-unquote adulthood, next chapter. So we're going to spend a little bit of time on the developmental side of psychology. Okay, so study of development or developmental psychology, obviously it's a one of the larger kind of sections of psychology. It's the study of how people grow and change throughout life. It's not surprising at all, perhaps, that the experiences that you have, early childhood experiences, are going to affect us as children, as adolescents, as adults. We know it's a part of our development. Okay. How many people have seen, or, well, I don't think they made a movie of it, but how many people have read the book A Child Called It? A few, anyway. Does anybody know what happened to that person?
Besides writing the book.
See, now, I've only read little pieces
three,
of it.
There's one with him in the posture.
The last boy.
Okay.
And then the last one is like,
no, it's his
psychology. Yeah. And I use this example not really because I know a tremendous amount about it, but because I've kind of heard it from other people, and I've read pieces of one of the books anyway. Obviously, horribly abused as a child, right? Like, I can't even remember all the different details, but the boy was kept down in the basement. What's that?
He got stabbed once.
He was
threw a knife on
us. He was basically just humiliated. Was he burned at one point?
Yeah,
he was on the stove.
She locked him in the bathroom with ammonia and stuff. And
broke his arm.
Yeah. Well, again, not having really read the story, but knowing a little bit about the story and kind of the impact that that would have, it got me thinking just about, imagine your childhood, compare it to that childhood, and try to picture yourself as you might have been. You know, we don't know exactly how much of who we are comes from our parenting, but you can imagine that you would probably not be exactly the same. Okay. I don't know how different you would be, but I mean, you could probably theorize that perhaps you wouldn't be maybe as socially comfortable. Perhaps you wouldn't trust maybe as easily with friends. Perhaps you wouldn't, I could see not being comfortable around adults because you might have associations with what your parents have done to you. Different things like that. Those early childhood experiences, we know they affect us. They know that they affect how we develop and how we get to be who we are. So obviously that's a huge question for psychologists and the people in the field looking at development. So if you want to try to look at it objectively, they've got to come up with a system for breaking down studying to kind of uncover some of the developmental problems that show up. Low self-esteem. Self-esteem is going to come up kind of over and over again in this chapter, in the next chapter. Trying to figure out what makes us kind of well-adapted, high functioning, feel good about ourselves, and what doesn't. It does seem, and I don't know what the studies exactly would say on this, but it does seem that we have an innate tendency towards trying to preserve our self-esteem. That can be even to the point of denial, kind of denying maybe things about ourselves that maybe we're a little bit lazy and we tend to blame it on something else, and then maybe we get, you know, a bad grade here because we just kind of sloughed off, and we kind of tell ourselves things like, well, I just couldn't do it, or it was my mom's fault. It does seem like overall, that's just one example, but it does seem like overall we have an innate tendency to try to preserve our self-esteem. But it's a question over and over that we're going to see come up. You know, what creates high self-esteem? What creates low self-esteem? And you can imagine if you were the child called it, what would your self-esteem be like? Would it be on the same level that it is today? Chances are probably not. So in trying to figure out what leads to development, how we go about studying development, one of the two of the most common ways of studying development over time in adolescents, in children, I know we're looking at infants and children right now, one of the most common ways of looking at it would be the longitudinal study. Gotta collect information. The longitudinal study is observing a group over a period of time, years, decades. It's a methodology which is time consuming. It's very expensive. It's great. It gives you a lot of good information of how people develop over time. But you can imagine trying to, maybe you want to write a research paper on how people develop. Do you want to wait 5 years? Do you want to wait 10 years to finalize that research paper? That's really time extensive. It's hard to do. It might be quite accurate information, but it's kind of tough to do. But that's one way that you can learn how people develop. And that's one way that psychologists go about learning how people develop. An example of this might be, if I were to measure the self-esteem of this class, say I could come up with some kind of objective way, some kind of test. I'm sure I could find one on the internet if I Googled it. If I were to find some kind of test that would assess objectively your self-esteem right now, and I were to give everybody in this class that test right now, and then I were to have you all come back in 2 years and take it again, and I was to have you come back in another 2 years and take it again, and take it again in 2 years after that, maybe I'd have you do it 5 times in 10 years or so. That would be a longitudinal study. I'm getting data from you at different points throughout your life, different developmental stages throughout your life, kind of moving from, at this point, adolescence into late adolescence into adulthood. And I could see if some of that data indicated that there were trends or patterns in how your self-esteem was changing over that time. Hopefully it would be going up and up and up and up. But I would be looking for patterns inside of that, and that would be an example of a longitudinal study. Another way, again, kind of taking shortcuts a little bit, because of the difficulty in doing longitudinal studies to get that information on development, another type of study that is used is the cross-sectional study. This is where you take a sample of people of different ages. You do it all at once. You compare them at one point in time. Okay, so if instead of taking this whole class and giving you a self-esteem thing and bringing you back every 2 years, I'm not going to be able to publish my results for 10 years. That's kind of frustrating to me. I want to get my PhD right now, right? Instead, maybe I take, you know, two 15-year-olds, and I take two 20-year-olds, and I take two 25-year-olds, and I take two 30-year-olds. I'd probably want more than that if I wanted to have a half-decent study. But if I spread it out and I handed out these surveys to people at all different ages all at once, and then I collected that data, I could do basically the same thing at one point in time that I was doing with you guys over the course of 10 years. Would it be as reliable? Not necessarily. Why might it not necessarily be as reliable? In the example that I just laid out for you, if I was to take, say, two 15-year-olds, two 20-year-olds, instead of testing you guys every 5 years, why might it not be as reliable the second way going about it, John?
You're changing more than one variable. You're changing the people rather than just the time.
Yep. I'm not just changing the time. I am changing the people that I'm studying. So when I try to draw conclusions, it's difficult because all of a sudden the 15-year-olds that I'm studying are not the same people as the 20-year-olds. So if I'm trying to draw a conclusion about how self-esteem is changing over those 5 years, well, maybe the 15-year-old I studied had really high self-esteem and the 20-year-old has really low. That's tough to say. If I keep the same sample, if I keep you guys, okay, I know that those patterns are probably going to make a little bit more sense. I'm working with the same people. I can compare your self-esteem and how it's changing over time. Okay. It's a little bit more difficult with a cross-sectional study, but again, it's quicker and cheaper, and that matters in life. Sometimes you have to be able to get information at a more rapid rate. Two main issues that developmental psychologists are concerned with are ways heredity environment influence development, okay, and also whether development occurs gradually or in stages. And you're going to get theorists that will say that development occurs in both of those ways, both kind of in stages or kind of as if you're changing kind of in a rocky, stage-like way, or if it's pretty continuous. So the first concern that we were talking about, the impact of both the environment and the biology or heredity is going to be a primary focus of developmental psychologists. Again, we just have to refamiliarize ourselves when we're talking about heredity. We're also going to use the terms nature. When we're talking about environment, we're also going to use the terms nurture. Again, nothing new. We've talked about it before. They've come up many, many times. And this is, you know, it's one of the big questions of psychology. How much of who we are comes from our environment? How much of who we are comes from biology? When we're talking about the biological or hereditary side of development, we'll call that maturation. It's an automatic sequential process of development resulting from genetics. So it's the idea that our DNA kind of like, it's like winding up a clock in the beginning. If you wind up that clock, the clock's going to run at least for a while. Well, with maturation, the idea is that with our DNA already being inside of us, we're going to go through a certain process of maturing over time, a certain process of developing over time. An example is going to be that we're going to have a sequence where we're growing and developing, like starting off with crawling, standing, and walking. Nobody starts off walking and then moves to standing and then crawling, for the most part, unless they're really tired, I guess. We all go through this sequence, this maturation, which tells you that it's not really a choice. It's probably not really something that just has to do with parenting or anything like that. It's quite obviously something in our DNA, the way that we're born. So that's the process that we call maturation. It's that sequence of events. And we have these sequences inside of us, much like we talked about with circadian rhythms, these processes that we go through on a daily basis, but also over the course of our lives, the sequence that we go through called maturation. Studies find that the rate of maturation that we go through is determined by genetics. Very difficult to offer you or to alter. You can parent all you want. You can do all kinds of different parenting styles. But when a baby's ready to walk, they're going to walk. You know, you can talk to them. You can show them. You can model how to walk and everything. But that doesn't seem to alter the rate at which the baby moves to that next step. That seems to be pretty much predisposed by their DNA, and by who they are biologically. Not that it's not worth trying, sitting there with a baby and saying, come on, come on, you can walk, you can walk. Inside the roles of nature and nurture, we find in development critical periods, or stages or points in the development during which a person or animal is best suited to learn a particular skill. We talked about language. We talked about how young kids seem to be able to pick up languages more easily than adults. Certain skills, once they're learned at an earlier age, stick pretty well. There do seem to be certain times where we pick things up a little bit better. And it's not just language. It might also be athletic skills. It might be a lot of different things. But there do seem to be periods in our development where we're predisposed to pick things up well. And times earlier on, if you try to teach a toddler to throw a baseball, it's not going to be very successful. If somebody never learns how to throw a baseball, and then, you know, they're 50 years old and you try to teach them how to throw a baseball, you're probably also going to have some difficulty. There does seem to be certain periods in time where your body's ready to take on new skills, new motor skills, new cognitive tasks, whatever it might be. We have different psychologists, one in particular named Giselle, that believed maturation, or the automatic sequence, the biological sequence we just talked about, played the most important role in development. Okay, that biology was kind of the driving force behind the development of the human being. Later on, we have John Watson with a pretty contrary approach. He thinks the environment is going to have the greatest impact, and it's going to be stronger than heredity, that the parenting, the environment that a child grows up in, is going to play a larger role in how they develop, physically, mentally, all of the above. And what do we find out in the end? Well, much like a good relationship, there's a compromise in the end. Most people today would say that it's, you know, definitely, if not equal parts, it's fairly close. That, yeah, our environment and parenting has a pretty good effect, but biology also has a pretty good effect. Again, if you step back to that maturation sequence that we talked about with the crawling and the standing and the walking, that is consistent. That's consistent across the board. Therefore, it can't just be parenting, because there are all kinds of different parenting styles and that sequence never changes. Okay, so we know a good part of that is biological. Two main theories in development are stage theory and continuity. Stage development is the idea that there are periods or levels in our development, developmentary processes that are distinct from the others. Okay? That instead of kind of a continuum or a smooth process, that it's like a stairwell. And that we're going up kind of one step at a time. That we go from, for example, from sitting to crawling to walking, and there all of a sudden there are really quick growth spurts in there. Okay? And you have very distinct differences in these different stages. How this applies to like a maturation theorist, they might say that when a child's legs all of a sudden become strong enough, the muscles develop enough to carry that child or support the child, the infant stands up, and before long, once you stand, unless you're just going to kind of teeter around there, well, you're going to start moving, and that kind of leads into walking. Okay, so the idea is that, you know, one thing develops enough that creates an entirely new behavior, okay, which leads to a very rapid change in behavior due to that development. Perhaps the most prolific stage theorist that we're going to look at is going to be Jean Piaget. We're going to look at him in quite a bit more detail as we go into our chapter. And he's going to focus more, not as much on the physical development, but more on the cognitive side and how children change with the way they perceive the world at different stages throughout. And there's going to be, you know, certain debate over exactly how much you can pin it down. Different, because he goes into basically different ages where if you're in this age group, you perceive the world in this way. These are your weaknesses cognitively and these are your strengths. So we'll cover him in more detail as we go along. But again, there's another theory, and that's the idea that our development is much more gradual and slow, and it's a slow process. It's not quite as herky-jerky as the stage theorists tend to espouse. And they point to examples like growth and height and weight, which for the most part, except for maybe early on in life, very early in life, inside the womb and infancy and stuff like that, it's fairly slow and steady. And they point to that and say that development on the whole is more of a steady process. So again, we kind of have a debate set up between these two camps on how development is taking place.